Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Politics is about protecting the next generation. Of course, it's about delivering for current generations. But, you know, we're experiencing problems that actually could have been prevented if we'd taken a long-term view.
We need to have young people in the decision-making room to hold our leaders and those who are going over to the delegation, going over to the summit, accountable so that we can have progressive, courageous policies and commitments.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Dale Stanley from the National Security College Futures Hub. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is being recorded, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. I'm really excited to invite two amazing women to our podcast today. Today, I'm joined by Sophie Howell, the first Future Generations Commissioner for Wales. She's been described as the world's first Minister for the Unborn. She's also one of our National Security College Futures Council members and has been here this week as a special guest at our National Security College conference, which was called Securing Our Future. I'm also joined by Caitlin Figueredo, the 2024 ACT Young Australian of the Year and the former co-chair of the Australian Youth Affairs Coalition, which is a national voice representing 4.7 million young Australians. You both have incredible bios and we have a lot to discuss today. And I think our listeners are probably wondering, why is a National Security College podcast talking about not only the future, but also intergenerational issues in a security context? And I think it's great that we have you both here to broaden that conversation about what is national security. How do we ensure we have diverse voices in the room when we're thinking about policy development? Not only diverse, but a long-term vision about where we're headed and why it's important that we include generational voices in our decision-making and policy development. So, Sophie, I might start with you and welcome, please, my warm welcome to you both.
So why are we talking about this? Well, I mean, I think if we look at some of the big challenges that are facing us in the future, challenges which the national security world is all about anticipating and, you know, guarding against and protecting and so on. Those big challenges are also the challenges which our future generations are very well aware of and are experiencing and actually have been probably shouting about for a long time before it's become mainstream in political discourse. So things like climate change, probably one of the biggest threats to security of Australia and indeed the world, the impacts of climate change in terms of increased droughts and flooding and disease and the potential for immigration and, you know, all of those things, huge threats. And it is our younger generations who've been really on the case of politicians to be really taking this seriously, and we're still not there. if we think about things around the threats around AI, around mis and disinformation, our younger people are digital natives, are current, and that means they've grown up in a digital world. If the average age of a politician in Australia is about 51, they are not digital natives. So the way in which they conceive the world in that space is completely different. And then things like social cohesion. Well, again, our younger people are growing up with different constructs around gender and identity, and so on, which are perhaps quite different to the way in which our older and current decision makers are thinking about things or even understand. So actually, if we want to prepare for the future, I think there's a moral and ethical case around, involving a diverse range of voices, including younger generations. But if that's not your starting point, if your starting point is security, you are absolutely missing a trick if we're not taking these insights from the next generation.
Mm. So Caitlin, in 2017, you co-founded the Girls Take Over Parliament. You also completed a Masters of National Security here at the ANU. What are your thoughts on including young voices in policymaking at the moment?
Yeah, so I think it's vital, actually, when you're looking at the demographics of Australia, for example. Young people make over 22% of the population. Every single decision, a piece of legislation that is being created and discussed in Parliament, it impacts and it intersects with young people today, but also their futures. So all the good decisions that Parliament makes, and in particular all the bad decisions and everything that they leave out or they're not prioritising, is almost left to to young people, to the next generations. And what I'm sort of saying, and why I'm so passionate about bringing and centering the voices of young people to have intergenerational dialogues, to having intergenerational policy making, is that for generations and for decades, young people were literally cut from the decision making table. So back in 2013, the Abbott government decided to cut the youth sector and to cut any youth representation within cabinet. And so what we have seen over the last decade is young people and their futures not being considered. And we're having all these issues that young people are facing, and they're creating a security crisis for themselves. And so that's why we need youth voices in Parliament, because they are the ones who are inheriting all of these crises, and they're going to have to deal with it because they can't be willfully blind anymore, which is what has been happening.
Mm. And Sophie, you spoke a little bit about social cohesion and understanding diverse voices. I think it'd be really great for our listeners to understand your journey from a Welsh perspective in measuring well-being. What does that even mean for people? We're so used to measuring things like economic development and those sorts of changes. But what does well-being mean, and why did Wales decide it was important?
Okay, well, a little bit of a sort of potted history to how there came to be a Future Generations Commissioner in Wales. That came from the Welsh Parliament in 2015 passing something called the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act. And it really started its life as a frustration from some politicians, but also, external organisations around the short-termism of politics, the fact that, we weren't really joining the dots between different policy areas. We had a duty in the law that established the Welsh Parliament to make sustainable development a central organising principle of the government, but, lofty ambition, but didn't really mean anything in practice. So there was a real movement to say, politics is about protecting the next generation. Of course, it's about delivering for current generations. But, we're experiencing problems now, and this was back in 2015, that actually could have been prevented if we'd taken a long-term view. And, fast forward 9 years and we're still experiencing globally many of those problems which could have been prevented. If you think about the cost of living crisis that we're in at the moment, which is occupying the minds of politicians and, of course, particularly citizens, energy security, if we'd taken a long-term view, an action on that, perhaps the energy bills wouldn't be as high, issues around poor mental health, issues around around health inequality and so on. So Wales decided that we wanted to get beyond political cycles and take this long-term view. And we thought if we're going to take a long-term view, actually the first thing we need to do is to create a vision of the Wales that we want to leave behind to future generations. So we held a national conversation with our citizens that were called The Wales We Want. And we posed the question to them, what's the Wales you want to leave behind to your children, your grandchildren and future generations to come? And that's quite novel because governments don't tend to have those conversations with citizens. We have very narrow conversations. Do you like this policy that we're proposing or not? When you give space to have that more open, future-focused dialogue, you very much get into the sense of like what matters to people. And, you know, no one said in that conversation what matters is an increase in GDP. What they did say, they also didn't say what matters is, you know, how quickly can I get an appointment with my doctor or so on. Not saying that that's not important. But what they said is, you know, actually, we want people to have opportunities. We want to protect our natural heritage and our environment. We need to pass that on to the next generation. We want to pass on our language, our culture, our heritage. We believe a sense of community and communities coming together are really important. And yes, our health and well-being is really important. But actually, we want to create the conditions that enable us to have good health, not just treat us when we're ill. So coming back to the question, what is well-being? Sometimes it can get a bit confusing. I think it's a bit like a word, a bit like resilience. Resilience can mean kind of, you know, resilience from a security perspective. It can mean community resilience. It can mean the resilience of your mental health and so on. And well-being is a little bit like that. But when we talk about well-being in Wales, and we've set this out in law, so it's not a vague concept, we are talking about societal well-being. We are talking about the things that enable people and planet to thrive. So those are things like what I just described. So in Wales, through that conversation with citizens, 7 long-term well-being goals were established based on what citizens told us was important to pass on to next generations. And there are statutory duties on our government and all of our main public institutions to show how they are delivering or helping to achieve those long-term well-being goals, which don't change from one political cycle to the next. And then my job as the first Future Generations Commissioner for Wales was to hold the government and those other institutions to account on how they were doing that.
Mm. So impressive. Caitlin, what do you think about this? You're someone that's talking to citizens and young people and translating that into a conversation with government or into parliament. How could we do this here?
I think when I first heard about what was happening in Wales, I became so excited because thinking about future generations, taking a long-term approach is something that is inherent to my culture as a Goan woman, as a First Nations woman. We always think about the next generations. How can we be good ancestors? And so when I hear Sophie talking about this and Wales taking this approach, it's the idea that every single citizen, how can we as individuals, not just the government, how can we be good ancestors? And I think within the Australian context, we have the oldest living culture in the world. This is something that First Nations communities, it's inherent. It's looking at how can we protect and take care of country? How can we ensure the well-being of those to come? And this is something that I've been trying to do with government since 2015. So I think it's really interesting that we have a very similar timeline. Haven't gotten as far as what Wales has done, but the conversations are just starting in Australia. My focus was, okay, how do we rebuild the youth sector? How do we make young people important again to government? How do we make sure that both of the aisles consider young people? And we have that foundation now. Since in 2022, the Abbott government came in, he refunded the youth sector. We have an office for youth and we have a minister for youth in Minister Anne Arley. I think this is great. And I think we can take examples from Wales and we can look at our cultural diversity. We can look at our First Nations principles and be led by First Nations peoples to go, actually, this is inherent to the Australian identity. This is inherent to us as a continent, as a country for over 65,000 years. And how this would work would be, one, we need politicians to start working and talking with our communities. I think what Wales did with a national consultation about actually bringing young people through deliberative democracy, through these conversations about who do we as Australians want to be? What are our values? Not just rather what the politicians' values for our country are, because I think they would actually be kind of different, especially from a young person's perspective. What we value, what we want to value is very different, and that being a part of that narrative. And then it would be co-designing a very similar process. And I think it could happen, but we just need courage and we just need to work with political leaders and go, this is actually not a partisan issue. This is not something that can be weaponized. This is actually super important to not only young people, but to the future security of our country.
Mm-hmm. And I think when you take that approach, and I love the points around seventh generation thinking and Indigenous cultures, and, you know, really, you kind of don't need to reinvent the wheel here. That thinking is embedded in this country already. Perhaps it's not as prominent as it should be, but actually Indigenous wisdom around protecting the planet, around passing that on to future generations, around the sense of looking after each other and community and so on. All of those things are important, you know, historically, currently, and for the future. And I think that there's certainly something around creating that vision for a country. I like to use this analogy, which I can't claim to be my own, but I was talking about what we were doing in Wales, and someone in Aotearoa, New Zealand, actually said, "Oh, it's a bit like your sat nav." Now, I say sat nav because I'm old. my kids would say Google Maps. What she said is, when I was describing the seven wellbeing goals set out, this vision for Wales, so it's kind of like our North Star. So when we're devising policy, when we're thinking about doing things, the questions we're posing are, you know, is that going to help or hinder us getting towards these long-term goals that have been set by citizens? So she was saying it's like your sat-nav, where, you know, you put your address in if you want to go somewhere, and your sat-nav is clever enough now to, you know, it's going to take you there, and it might take you off in a different direction if there's a roadblock or a diversion or congestion or whatever it might be, but eventually it's going to get you there. The problem with most countries in the world is they don't have an address, so they don't have a direction of where they want to go in the long term. So you get public policy, which is just sort of, you know, ranging around the place with no particular coherence. And it's also not able to judge from a futures perspective, what are the things that we really need to be kind of watching out for? You know, what do we need to be anticipating in terms of things that might take us away from our goals? Or on the positive side, what are the things that could be really helpful in accelerating our progress towards the goals? So that's where I think this like long-term vision helps to bring more coherent policy. And of course, it also does help in some of these big intergenerational challenges like climate, where we have systematically failed to address these issues because they need a long-term view.
And you were saying that the goals are hard to argue with.
They are. I mean, you know, the goal of, you know, creating the conditions where people's physical and mental health and well-being can thrive and people are able to make the right healthy choices. The goal of cohesive communities, a safe, attractive, well-connected and vibrant communities, enhancing the goal of a resilient Wales, where we mean ecological resilience, enhancing, maintaining, restoring nature and ecosystems, you know. They're kind of just common sense. Why would we not want to do those things? And yet somehow public policy does fail to do those
things. But despite government, whichever government is in charge, they can't be argued with. They make sense. Mm-hmm. They've been agreed to by citizens. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It would be great to hear a kind of example of what are some of the issues that came across your desk that were somewhat challenging but really put into action the decision-making powers that you had in the role?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, you know, the first biggest test of the legislation was the government had plans to spend the entire of their borrowing capacity. Wales is a relatively small nation. They just got these borrowing powers from the UK government. And they wanted to spend all of their borrowing capacity on building a, a 13-mile stretch of motorway to deal with a problem of congestion. And that's just, you know, that's status quo thinking. And if you apply long-term thinking to that, there are all sorts of issues around, you know, what is mobility going to look like in the future? This was pre-COVID, actually. And even pre-COVID, the trends around different models of working, working from home, remote working, were developing slowly. Obviously, they were accelerated through COVID. But also that kind of test of how well is building a road going to maximise the contribution to those seven wellbeing goals. So the questions that I posed as commissioner were, so our goal of prosperity talks about a productive, innovative, low carbon society, one which uses resources efficiently, proportionally. We build a road, we increase carbon emissions, you know, fact. And not just from the travel on the road, even if we go completely electric, we've still got decades before we can make back the carbon we've spent on actually constructing the road. The road was going to go through a nature reserve, damaging our ecosystem. So it doesn't stack up with the goal of a resilient Wales. If we think about the goal of a healthier Wales, I imagine similar to Australia, we've got increasing and worrying rates of obesity, about 58% of our adult population are overweight or obese. That leads to long-term health conditions. That leads to pressure on public spending, so on and so on. We also have illegal levels of air pollution, which most countries in the world do. So tell me how spending all this money on building a road stacks up with that. And also tell me how it stacks up with our goal of a more equal Wales, because 25% of the lowest income families in this region don't own a car. And the problem with building roads, not only it not stacking up in terms of those broader concepts on wellbeing, is that also, if you look at any of the data, it'll tell you that when you build roads like that, within about 10 to 15 years, that road is just as full as the original road that you had, because we've never dealt with the root cause of the issue, which is people don't have any other options around public transport and active travel and so on. So we have to take some difficult decisions, you know, and in many ways that was unpopular. You know, it's frustrating if you're stuck in congestion, isn't it? But we have to take a long-term view to say, okay, we can't just carry on doing the same things and expecting different results. We've got to start doing some different things. So the money we were going to spend on that road has now been invested in public transport. Now there's a lag there, isn't there? Because you can't just say we're going to switch spending and suddenly you're going to have a really efficient and brilliant public transport system. But this week in Wales, actually, the first part of a South Wales metro system is starting to come online, and that's because we're diverting our money. So there are lots of other examples, like reforms to our education system and the things that our kids are learning in school, moving away from rote learning and knowledge, which, you know, Caitlin, if I asked you what you want, you know, if you want to know something now, what do you do?
I Google it.
Yeah, there you go. Right. So
and you don't like emails, is that right?
No, yeah. I don't like emails. You Google it and it's like, why is our education system then requiring our young people to undertake, you know, 2 or 3 hour exams where they're required to regurgitate a load of knowledge? It's utter madness. It's not fit for current generations and the current world of work, let alone what it's going to look like in the future. So what about reforming our education system around, you know, placing our physical and mental health and well-being of our young people as a core part of the curriculum, which we've done in Wales? What about making them ethical, informed global citizens? Also what we've done in Wales. What about looking at the power of creativity? Because when robots take over the world, you know, a bit flippant there, but, you know, the stuff that makes us human, that creative power, is going to be the really important skill. So we need to be preparing our young people now, yes, for those jobs and what the world of work is going to look like in the future. And it's going to look, you know, very different to the world of work now. But also we need to prepare them for a life well lived. And that's another example of some of the reforms
I think
in Wales.
What strikes me as someone that supports government in policy making through our work in the Futures Hub is the challenge of working across portfolios and within departments where these issues are cross-cutting. So ensuring that, you know, you've just described health, age, you know, aged care, transport, a whole range of really complex policy development. And so it's really breaking down those silos and understanding that when a transport issue came to you, it actually had major flow-on effects and that we needed to think much more broadly and consult much more widely on what this could look like out 10, 20 years or even longer. And I think it's ensuring that we bring together the right diverse voices to question the policies and strategies to ensure that they are fit for purpose. I think that's a great example. And Caitlin, I was going to ask you, how does that sit with you? What's on your mind as the young person in the room? How does this example kind of resonate with you?
Everything that Sophie's saying, I'm just like, yes, okay, this is everything that I think about on a daily basis and I want to see happen here in Australia. I think the thing that I'm frustrated about, and I know a lot of people, and not just young people, politicians themselves, the issue that we have in Australia is that we have one of the shortest parliamentary terms in the world. When I describe the system to young people, I'm like, okay, this is why we can't get shit done. Because think about it, right? We have a 3-year term. The first year is focusing on the 100 days. How do we quickly demonstrate that the government is delivering on their agenda so they don't get in trouble by the media and they don't get in trouble by the voters? And then the next year is about, okay, expanding it a little bit more, but they're really starting to set up for the third year. The third year is not about long-term policy. It's about what can we start selling to the Australian people to then get us re-elected. We do not have a system that is designed for long-term decision-making, long-term policy-making. And so this is why I think having a legislative system or a set of overarching goals is not only good for policymakers or our politicians to start thinking, oh, okay, intergenerationally, what does the future of our country, what type of expenditure do we need to make right now that will cost a lot of money? Everything that, like Sophie's thinking about from an Australian context, because we have such a large population, such a diversity of issues and competing priorities, especially when we talk about the national security and the regional security of it and what's happening in our region with climate change, what's happening that we're going to have massive forced migrations when, for example, Tuvalu the Tuvalu Pact is a really interesting example of short-term thinking around these climate issues when, yes, we have a migration pact to bring citizens of Tuvalu to Australia, but then it's like, okay, they're going to lose their land. Climate change will destroy Tuvalu. And what happens to them? What happens to their culture? What happens if they come to Australia? What happens to their sovereignty and that respect? And so these are really complex issues. And so from my perspective, we need to implement something like this in Australia. We need to start having these discussions, and it will definitely help frame our departments and our public servants to start thinking about this way and start pushing and challenging the short-term agenda that we're seeing in this country.
We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
Maybe that's a nice segue into sort of lifting up the conversation to the United Nations work that's going on. You've both engaged with the UN in different capacities. Caitlin, you with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. We're so used to saying the SDGs. And Sophie, you're an advisor to the UN Secretary General. And we know there's a Summit of the Future coming up this year. Does this give us some guiding hope that there will be some commitments made and that this might trickle down on a global sense and to Australia? What do you both think? Perhaps, Sophie, you could start.
Well, I think it's an exciting moment. So just to put the context of what's up for debate at the moment. So the UN Secretary General has proposed that there should be a UN summit for the future held in New York in September. At the moment, there is a pact for the future being negotiated through the UN system that is looking at a range of things from, you know, AI, security, environment, climate, but also, and this is the bit that I'm particularly interested in, governance for intergenerational equity, because I think the big challenge that we've got, and if we just take climate, for example, you know, you'll get your media reports every year of, you know, all the world leaders, off they go to COP to discuss the climate crisis and what they're going to do about it. And back they, and they make a load of commitments, and back they come the following year, having actually delivered on very few of those commitments. Why is that? It's because when they come back to base, when they come back to their own countries, their systems, as Caitlin rightly said, does not facilitate long-term and joined-up thinking and acting. And the sorts of difficult decisions in many cases that we need to be taking on climate, and, you know, the investments that we need to be made, we're not going to see the results of those, you know, within the next electoral cycle. So it's actually our system of government and governance that prevents us from doing these things properly. So if we get some really ambitious work going on in that summit and the pact for future generations and you know, proposals around reforms of government governance, that has the potential to have a trickle down effect to all of the member states in the United Nations, who will have to look at reforming their own systems of governance to embed this sort of long term thinking and intergenerational equity. So there's a real opportunity and moment around there. What if it's not ambitious? And sometimes these UN negotiations can be really turgid and it becomes a bit of a race to the bottom and so on and so on. Actually, you know, I think that there are countries across the world, you know, Wales is a tiny nation, but countries across the world looking at what we've been doing and looking at how they might be able to do something similar. We're seeing a significant shift even here in Australia on towards measuring what matters, towards measuring well-being, saying yes, you know, the economy is a significant part of what we, you know, of what we want governments to be focused on, but the economy should be in service to people and planet, not the other way around. So there are people entering into this more progressive space, and I'm, you know, I'm not so optimistic that, you know, we at all need to take our foot off the gas, which is the wrong analogy when we've been talking about climate. Let's take our foot off the bike pedals or what have you. I'm not so optimistic that we should slow down, but I think we also need to be not so pessimistic that we think everything's a kind of lost cause and there are some shoots of progress in countries across the world.
Before I jump to Caitlin, I might just quickly ask, which countries are really leading the way and advocating for this sort of change?
Well, we're seeing, oh gosh, Scandinavian countries, as you would imagine, but in the global south, the global majority, there's some really interesting work happening in Kenya around their parliament, looking at, you know, how they could embed intergenerational equity into decision making. Of course, we saw New Zealand as one of the early adopters of the wellbeing budget. I think Scotland in the UK will be the next country to legislate to have a Future Generations Act. Some really exciting stuff that I've been involved in more recently in these dialogues coming from a range of different youth sectors, futurists, people working with politicians themselves in Portugal and in Spain. At a EU level, I was in Brussels a couple of weeks ago talking to the cabinets of EU commissioners about the prospect of an EU commissioner for future generations and a parliamentary rapporteur. So there's stuff happening all over the place. And I think there's something here for Australia to say, look, do we want to be ahead of the game here? Do we want to be in the front runners on this? Or do we want to be the, you know, the less progressive laggards? And I know where I'd want to be.
Caitlin, what do you think?
I think it's really interesting when you hear the government, you hear the foreign minister talk about our place in the region, and we're a middle power, but we want to be leaders. And I think when you've got the Summit of the Future, this is a really prime opportunity for Australia to be a leader in it, given we are a middle power. We have such diversity in our cultures, with our age, with how we approach life and our place in the region. And I think we have almost 50% of our region is comprised of young people. This is where we need to be leaders and bringing the region together, seeing all of these taking all these Indigenous specific knowledge and ways of thinking and being and doing to the summit. But what is really sad, I think, is that this is happening. This is a monumental time for us to be engaged in international dialogue. But as someone who did work with the United Nations and I helped create the Commission of the Status of Women Youth Forum, because we needed a space specifically for young people to talk about what are our gender priorities? How can we start shifting the dialogue? What can we do on the local levels but interact it with the national and international spaces? That is actually not respected within Australia, that the international context or even being a good neighbour or our social licence to engage with international spaces is not really supported by the general Australian populace. That is a lot to do with the media, a lot to do with our, we need to take care of our own backyard before we think about anyone else. And I think when you're trying to think about the future and all of the issues that we are quickly inheriting, we're approaching multiple cascading disasters. We're heading toward a climate catastrophe. This is where we need to have citizenship involvement, where we as Australians need to be thinking about it, not just leaving it up to the politicians. But in particular, we need to have young people in the decision-making room to hold our leaders and those who are going over to the delegation, going over to the summit accountable so that we can have progressive, courageous policies and commitments.
Well said.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely spot on there. And I think that, you know, it's fascinating as well that this week we're also seeing some really significant legal cases around climate in particular. But the ones, there have been a number of climate cases taken by young people around, you know, duty of care. And of course, you've got Senator Pocock leading a duty of care bill here. But actually, the ones taken by young people, I think on some technicalities, haven't actually progressed. But the one that's won this week has actually been taken by a number of older women in Switzerland who have argued that governments failing to protect their interests in terms of climate is having a direct impact on their health and well-being and so on. And I think that, you know, there's something, whilst I think that's brilliant, I also think that it's, there's something around, gosh, young people have been saying this for a long time and are not necessarily being heard. And I think that it's so important, therefore, that we need to be really listening to what they're saying. And also, Caitlin, your point on how we're thinking about things internationally and globally. I think that these big challenges, climate, AI, biodiversity loss, breakdown in democracy, these sort of go beyond country boundaries, and we need that coming together in a multilateral space to try and deal with some of them. So it's really short-sighted in terms of even just protecting national security that, you know, you start with a position of, you know, it's all about what we do in this nation. Actually, it's about what we do more broadly. We're not going to, you know, in the UK and here in Australia, it's going to be really challenging to, as an individual, in individual nations, to protect ourselves from the effects of climate change and to manage those things when they happen. And so we're going to have that global cooperation, both on trying to prevent and mitigate and sadly dealing with the effects.
I think also from a national security perspective and the conversations that we have, it's about managing risk, and it's about, you know, quite stressful or important conversations. But what I love about the Welsh vision is that it's positive and it's about a hopeful future, that visionary kind of sense of where we want to go, what do we want to be doing. And we have to ensure that futures conversations also have that element to it. And I think with good futures work, often it can be difficult to measure how effective it's been, because if you've done it well, you might have avoided the future that you didn't want to happen, or you've created the one that you visioned. And so how has Wales kind of thought about that? Has how have you reflected on things you might do differently now, or how have you measured the success of that work?
Well, you're absolutely right that this is a long-term mission. We have 50 national indicators which track progress against our long-term wellbeing goals. And, you know, what we can see over the first 8 years or so of the legislation is that, you know, some are going in the right direction and some aren't. It's, you know, measures have their place, but I also think that we are not sophisticated enough as yet in terms of how we measure change really holistically. So, you know, for example, in Wales, and, you know, this is not something that we are at all proud of, child poverty has increased. Now, actually, that's because Wales doesn't have the levers in terms of welfare in particular, and that rests still in the UK government of there, and there's been some real substantial cuts there. So it's no wonder that we're seeing, therefore, you know, kids in Wales going into poverty. However, the flip side of that is that the initiatives that Wales, the areas that Wales controls, and what we're putting in place now around the importance of physical and mental health in the school curriculum, universal free school meals for children, a focus on early intervention in families who need that support, particularly in the first 1,000 days of life. So that's from pregnancy to age two, where we know that that's where, you know, early life chances are most fundamentally formed. We would expect to see changes over probably a generation in terms of what comes out there. And I think, you know, there's some really live things here in Australia at the moment, the stuff that's going on in Alice Springs, which I've been following on the news. This isn't, you know, and I say this as someone who was the Deputy Police Commissioner in Wales's largest police force before I came the Future Generations Commissioner. This is very much presented at the moment like a policing problem. Mm. This, and, you know, at the moment, because of the crisis, it is a policing problem. But actually, this is public policy failure. Mm. This is public policy failure to invest in the early years, in the supportive interventions, on, you know, to tackle poverty, to tackle deprivation, in these families. I heard some of the local politicians talking about high rates of domestic abuse, and we have all the evidence to show that when children grow up in those scenarios, they're, you know, these sorts of things are almost inevitable, and yet our public policy has not responded. And, you know, and I'm not placing a sole criticism here in Australia, because this happens all over the place. But I guess what I'm saying is that we need to be looking at these measures holistically. We need to be looking at what are the conditions we're creating for children, family, for society. And I'm going to give a shout out to a friend of mine, Catherine Trebek, who founded the Wellbeing Economy Alliance. And she's been talking about measures such as the number of girls who ride a bike to school. So you're probably thinking, hang on, what the hell? What's that about? But if you just think about that, that is about road safety. Is it, you know, as a mum, we're both mums, Dale and I, would I feel happy for my daughter to ride a bike to school safely? It's then looking at, are we reducing air pollution? Because obviously there's no air pollution, you know, there's no fumes from a bike. We're looking at equity, because girls are far less likely to cycle than boys. We're looking at reducing our carbon emissions. We're looking around how safe more broadly our communities are. So actually it's quite an interesting...
Physical health,
exactly that. So it's actually quite an interesting measure. And I think there's a lot of work to be done to look at what could be those measures. I was talking last night about, what about a measure of, you know, do you get the Sunday dread when you go to, you know, about going to work on a Monday? Now, like, how many of us have had the Sunday dread? But if we were creating a workforce and an economy and a way of thinking about, does our employer care about our physical and mental health? Do I feel I've got purpose in my job? All of those sorts of things. You would expect to see the Sunday dread
drop.
Yeah. And so it sounds a bit wacky, but these are, you know, when you connect things that are actually relevant to people and communities, to how politicians take decisions and measure their impact, I think there's something really quite interesting there.
Caitlin, I can see you nodding.
I'm nodding because I'm just thinking about the Australian context, so but at the domestic level. So I used to work at the ACT government, and with ACT government, I think it was back in Oh, when did I join? I think 2020, 2021. They actually developed a wellbeing framework. And I cannot believe I just remembered this because it's so crucial to what we're discussing. And so the ACT government has a wellbeing framework. And so they do have all of these different sections of indicators and these frameworks around mental health and wellbeing, about the environment, about the livability of our cities. And so when you think of Canberra, for example, as the nation's capital, when we are designing new suburbs, we're thinking about what Sophie said. We're thinking about how accessible is it for people to ride and to be connected to the city? How much green space do we have? What is our air quality? How close is it for people to attend public parks and to work out? And every single element of the ACT government's policies has to go through the wellbeing framework. And so I think when we were talking about before, how would this sort of work and how would we start something like this and this conversation in Australia? Well, actually, the ACT is already doing it. And I know we're progressive and I know everyone is like, oh, the Canberra bubble, and they don't understand and we don't, they can't bring it elsewhere. I'm like, no, think about it. If we have an example here, is it everything? No, but it's an example that we can potentially start replicating within each state and territory around Australia, have a localized context, and then bring that up and use this as framework for a broader national policy context, so that we are having, again, because we have a Commonwealth, we have a federalized model, it's really difficult to bring up and down. But I think it could work. It started.
Well, Sophie and I are off to Perth to have this conversation in Western Australia next week. So we will join the East and West Coast and we'll report back.
I think there's, it's a really important point, and I've seen some of the work that's been happening in the ACT, and I think it's impressive. And I think there's a real opportunity now to join that up at a federal level. So again, you know, shout out to Jim Chalmers, the treasurer, who was been entering into this space. He's developed this Measuring What Matters framework, which is a decent starting point in terms of measuring beyond GDP and docking that into to wellbeing. I think the next phase is, how could you look at what's in that Measuring What Matters framework? And let's not just make it a kind of, we'll just measure stuff after the event, but it doesn't actually inform the stuff that we're going to do in the first place. Join that up with some of the states, maybe starting with the ACT, maybe you pilot with a couple of states, and look at where there's that alignment. How do federal treasury funds flow down into the states to help drive progress against these shared areas of wellbeing policy? And what progress could we make through doing that? And that is essentially what we've done in Wales. We've got the national wellbeing goals. The government have to deliver on them. At a local level, they have to be delivered on. And funding flows in that way, and policy is flowing in a way which is helping to facilitate that. And that's when you start to get some really progressive things happening, I think.
I think, I just thought of Australia's disaster response. So from a security perspective and a government perspective, in Australia, the Commonwealth government does not have a responsibility to, unless there is an absolute disaster, they don't have a responsibility to act in the case of a natural disaster, of a climate-induced disaster. That is the responsibility of the states. And so when we had the bushfire tragedy in 2019, there was this, and then we had the flooding as well. There was this community push going to the government from the local levels and to the federal government going, why aren't you acting? But it's because under the constitution, they can't, they don't have that prerogative. And so the government was like, okay, no, we have to have a coordinated approach. Yes, we're going to support the states, but in times of crisis, we're going to set up all of these bodies. So we're going to set up NEMA, for example, as a coordinating agency to bring up that local and federalized context, to be a coordinating actor. And I think if we could have like a body like that, if we could have a commissioner, but also a body kind of like NEMA, but looking at future generations, set up working with the states implement it on a local level, but federally you have these indicators that it's their responsibility to check in with each state and territory to go, what are you guys doing? How can we do it on a federal level? How can we coordinate it? I think that could work. We've established it already. Something like this, I think there are models existing that we can tap into.
Caitlin, I was interested, we were talking offline about COVID earlier and the sort of existential threats that actually increased the youth voice presence in the room. And I just wondered if you might want to talk a little bit about that as an interesting trend.
Yeah. So how essentially, so there was this movement from the youth sector and young people for about 6 years after all the youth sector funding was cut from the Commonwealth level. And there was so much advocacy and I was a part of it, and it was really difficult for us to continue to get pushback from government of going, thanks for coming, bringing this to attention. Young people are important, but you know what? Young people actually aren't really that important because they did nothing about it until we had COVID. When COVID hit, all of a sudden the government realized, oh, crap. We haven't set up any foundational support structures for young people. Young people are locked away from their friends, from their families. They are not thriving because of online schools. They're not thriving with their health and well-being. And we're seeing this mental health crisis, but also we're seeing shocks to their financial security. We're seeing rising rates of domestic violence, and this is impacting the long-term health and well-being of young people. And we didn't even have any... I'm talking about indicators. We didn't have any ways to go, okay, well, what matters to young people? What is really important? And so COVID was a shock to the system for government and as a little bit of a wake-up call. We, the youth sector and AAC, it's really bad, but we capitalized on this moment to advocate within government to ask them to, okay, reset up all of these structures. So the government came back with a emergency crisis youth response, and it was only a couple hundred thousand dollars, but it was a starting point that we were able to then start coordinating efforts. The government introduced an assistant minister for youth, who's also the aged minister as well, and he was dealing with a lot of issues. So youth kind of fell off the agenda. But again, it was that little opening door that we were able to utilize to then go to and start advocating across party lines to then go to the Albanese government and go, okay, you've now seen the problems. You've now seen what happens when you don't invest in young people. You see the long-term flow on effects that if you don't support their resilience now, if you don't support their well-being now, this has intergenerational issues. So, and then they started taking that on board, and we now have the framework that we do. But again, it's the foundation, it's the floor, it's not the ceiling.
Mm. All right, let's wrap up. So I think today we have really explored a broad definition of national security. We've covered a lot of issues from human health, the environment, the economy. I don't know if we tapped into technology so much, but I think this is an important conversation that I do really hope our listeners appreciate and get a different perspective on why futures thinking as a discipline, but also this intergenerational aspect is so important to how policymaking is undertaken here in Australia. And the words of wisdom that we've got from both of you today from different generations is so valuable. I'm going to wrap up by asking you each, what is one thing that you're hopeful for about the future?
I'm hopeful because I spend a lot of my time with young people. I've got a fair few of my own young people at home who keep me in check and tell me when I'm talking absolute nonsense. It happens. But also, you know, professionally, I spend a lot of my time with young people who, quite frankly, have much better ideas than me. And our older generations are, you know, often much sharper in terms of their thoughts and how to get there, and often really importantly, challenging to me and to other leaders. So they make me hopeful. But the trick now is, as Caitlin says, to get their voices in the room in a much more comprehensive way.
Okay. I think for me, we're starting to see a different kind of leadership. We're talking about leadership of empathy, leadership of courage, leadership of long-term decision-making, of how can we be good ancestors. This is making me very hopeful for the future. And we're bringing citizens into the room, into decision-making power. And I think we have an opportunity. Everything that is created right now, everything from society was created by mankind. So we can design our own futures that we want so that we can continue to thrive and leave it better for future generations.
Thank you to you both for joining me on the National Security Podcast today. Thanks, Sophie.
Thanks.
Thanks, Caitlin.
Thanks.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.